Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signa Darpinian, co-author of No Way and Raising Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. I want to welcome you today to part one of a three-part series on menopause, the brain, body, and nutrition in midlife and beyond. To start off part one, we are talking to a doctor who specializes in the brain and who is always on the cutting edge of scientific research into the female experience, Dr. Luann Brizendine. Dr. Brizendine is going to help us navigate the stages of menopause, cut through the controversy around hormone therapy, and give us steps for preserving the brain for the second half of our lives. Dr. Brizendine completed her degree in neurobiology at UC Berkeley, graduated from Yale School of Medicine, and did her internship and residency at Harvard Medical School. She also served on the faculties of Harvard University and University of California at San Francisco. She founded the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic at UCSF, and her New York Times bestseller, The Female Brain, and its follow-up, The Male Brain, continue to be read around the world. She recently released her new book, The Upgrade, How the Female Brain Gets Stronger and Better in Midlife and Beyond. Dr. Brizendine, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you all for having me. I'm just excited to talk to your audience because your audience is my audience. So
exactly.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, this is so great. And I have scoured your book. I'm a slow reader. I really took my time, but I took it all in. I wish I had this a couple years ago. It would have been very timely, but it's all right. Here we are.
Better late than never. And
right.
Listen, that's part of the thing for us women. This doesn't matter how long it takes you to get there. You know, we just get there. I only can do one step at a time, one day at a time.
Exactly. And I loved it. And I thought a good starting place for us would be to start with what you talk about, which is changing the conversation around quote unquote menopause. What are some of the words that you use that might be a little different from what we're used to around this conversation?
So I'm happy to switch back and forth, but the topic of the change and the transition from what is our cycles, our menstrual cycles, the hormone ups and downs that we have that are just, you know, marinating our bodies in a different amount of hormone every single day during our cycle. For all of our fertility years, from the time we start our period at age 10, 11, 12, 13, until we have our last period and about a year beyond that, in the average age is about 52 to 53. So we have had, you know, 40 years, let's say, of cycling in our bodies of the menstrual cycle. That is starting to change. You know, as you go into puberty, it's kind of drip, drip, drip. Not every period is the same. Sometimes you ovulate then and sometimes you don't in the lead up to puberty. So then you go through puberty in reverse,
okay.
AKA the perimenopause, or what I call the first stage of the transition. So you go through the transition on the other end of getting out of this cycle on the other end. That's why I call it the transition, because it really does go from between 2 and 9 years,
okay,
or more for some women, that you kind of have what I call sputtering ovary syndrome, where the brain and the body are miscommunicating, and we're going into the upgrade when that finishes, because your brain is not being jerked around every day with a different amount of hormones, and then freedom.
The way you're speaking about the upgrade, would it be happening after your final menstrual period?
Yes.
Okay. That is the upgrade, we hope.
Nothing is perfect in life, and there's all kinds of other things that we need to deal with. And that's why I talk in chapters 2, 3, and 4 about, you know, what you can do to help ameliorate any kind of symptoms you're having. And a lot of that has to do with just being courageous and bold enough to go to the doctor and have them help you manage your hormonal transition, because it's, you know, it's your life. You've only got one life. So just don't suffer, ladies.
And while we're sticking with language, I noticed in your book you don't use hormone replacement therapy.
Yes. You know, so there's been, that's kind of a change in the medical field. they used HRT, right? And we still say HRT. And, you know, it's one of those things where everybody says HRT still. But the medical profession has gone on to change it to HT, which means hormone therapy, because the idea that you are perfectly replacing the hormones that you lost, you know, is not what you're doing. You're actually adding hormones to a level that will make you feel better than dealing with your own hormones, because it's going to be usually a very stable, everyday, same amount of hormones instead of the fluctuating hormones of the menstrual cycle that's being controlled by the brain, the pituitary, and communicating with the ovaries, which has been in your body. So you're going to be on a more stable, constant dose, which doesn't jerk you around as much. So that's why they call it hormone therapy instead of hormone replacement therapy, because you're not trying to mimic what was being done to you before by your own body.
In your book also, you say that the transition and the upgrade happen almost exclusively in the brain. That's so hard to imagine. Can you break that down for us?
Okay. It actually is sort of cool because, I mean, listen, the master gland, the brain is called the master gland of the whole body.
Okay.
So the area called the hypothalamus and the pituitary, they are the conductors of the symphony of all the hormones in your body, including the hormones from your adrenal glands, you know, your adrenaline, if you have to run away from a lion or a tiger or what, you know, your hormones are being controlled by what your brain is sensing. And the ovaries are just, you know, hormone glands sitting down there waiting for the signal from the brain to turn on. And the brain is the place where the signal comes from to start puberty. Drip, drip, drip. It kind of says, wake up, wake up, wake up, little ovary. It's almost time at age like 10, 11, 12. You know, you know how little girls get those little breast buds?
Yes.
At about 9 or 10. And you know, within about 18 to 24 months, she'll start to have her period. That's because the brain is saying, wake up, little ovary, start making estrogen. It starts to make the estrogen, which makes those little breast buds. So if you see little girls with the breast buds, they are getting estrogen now from their ovaries because their brain is sending the signal down to the ovary to wake up.
I see. And then so what is the signal as in the transition?
So then in the transition, the signal is starting to get I call it sort of glitchy or sputtering back and forth, because the brain's sensitivity to the estrogen from the ovary is what tells the brain what to do next. So for example, think of a conductor of a symphony, and if the flute isn't playing loudly enough, what does a conductor do? It screams at them, or it splashes its baton, the baton at that instrument, like play louder, play louder, play louder. So if the ovary stops making as much estrogen, the pituitary conductor starts to scream down at that ovary to make more, make more, make more, in the form of that thing called follicle stimulating hormone, FSH. So that's where the doctor always measures your FSH to check how fertile you are, to check the condition of the ovaries. But that hormone it's measuring comes from the pituitary. So it's the conductor screaming at the ovary. So if the ovary's not making enough estrogen, the FSH starts to go really high. And so as the ovary's little follicles run out, remember we're given so many follicles at birth, and you know we ovulate like 400 times plus or minus some. Ovaries, the little follicle around the egg is what makes your estrogen. And as we run out of follicles, then we run out of estrogen, and the estrogen goes lower and lower and lower. And that's why the pituitary conductor in the brain is screaming at the ovary to make more, make more. But the ovary is getting ready to retire and run out of the eggs. So at some point, there's no more estrogen. And the conductor in the pituitary can make as much FSH and scream at that ovary as much as possible. But there's no more follicle down there. So that's why they measure your FSH to say if your FSH is over 25, you're going into menopause territory. You run out of eggs. Or if you're in a fertility clinic, because some women run out of eggs at age 38 or 37, 38, 39. And so the way to find out how many is, you know, it's a couple ways to find it out, but the basic kind of old-fashioned ways, FSH is, measured. And if that's higher than 25, you're probably not fertile anymore because you don't have enough eggs. So when you're a cycling fertile woman in your 20s and 30s, your FSH might be low. Like it could be like 6, 7, 10. You know, it's down there under 20 when your fertility and you got plenty of follicles to make estrogen. So that's just a little course in how they do it and why they do it. But it's the brain. So the brain, the pituitary and the hypothalamus in the brain are conducting, are the conductors of this symphony of the ovary.
I feel like I just learned so much, and I am 52, and now today at this moment is the first time that I understand why at 38 people were starting to say, did you maybe want to freeze some of those eggs?
Right?
Yeah, it all worked out.
Did you freeze?
I did not freeze. I had a happy accident.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it was a little off my radar. And
how old is your happy accident?
My happy accident is almost 14.
Woo!
Yeah.
Whoa,
so
the teenage.
Yeah,
the
she'll
teenage.
Be 14 and I'll be 53. But I was starting to get the talk, but I didn't understand why, and now I do.
Okay.
Now I do.
Girl.
It sounds like
she's turning on and you're turning off.
Exactly. Exactly. Which is, those are good times. And yeah, so it sounds like the FSH was doing all right at that time.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. Okay. So I know that not everyone has the same menopause transition symptoms. Not everybody has the same symptoms. The journey is really different for everybody. But I thought it might be good to increase awareness about some of the most common mood-related symptoms.
You know, I specialize in women's mood and hormones because I'm trained as a neuropsychiatrist. I'm trained in, like, mood symptoms. And that's one of the ways I got interested in the effects of hormones in the female brain that control our mood and our irritability and our sex drive and our sleep and, you know, our happiness and our sadness, you know, all that stuff. So, you know, yes, the getting into the symptoms that people are distressed over in the transition stage between age 42 and 52, I think one of the classical one is hot flashes, okay? Mm-hmm. Not everybody has hot flashes, but some women in their late 30s, early 40s, which I call the stage one of the transition, you start to be able, like, say you're exercising. Let's say maybe you're on an elliptical and you're used to getting off of it after 20 minutes and you know how long it takes you to drink some water, you know how long it takes you to cool down. And gradually you're finding, like, you're not cooling down so as fast. Your cooling system is a little bit slow. Like you may even take, you're walking around thinking, geez, it's been 20, 30 minutes and I'm still feeling really warm. That's sort of an indication of that stage one of your transition, okay, where your body's measurement of your internal body temperature is a little off. And the exact reason it happens, we don't know, but we have a thermostat inside our brain that keeps our body between a certain temperature. And this is kind of the basis of the hot flash. So that's kind of, I call it that a warm flush where you don't cool down. So that's stage one. And as you get further along, you know, you may get to the third stage of the transition that I talk about, you know, 4, 5, 6 years later. And then you're kind of in the full on, your body's, it's like, I'll give you the examples. Like if you walk into a room, you're sitting there and somebody turns the heat up by 10 degrees, everybody in the room, including you, will feel warm. If a perimenopausal, you know, menopausal woman walks into a room and they change the temperature by 1 degree, almost nobody else is feeling necessarily quote unquote warm and starts sweating. But the woman that's in this stage of life, in the perimenopause, menopause transition, she may start sweating and wondering why she's like dripping, right? It's the thermostat in your brain that's used to a certain amount of estrogen.
Okay.
It's basically gone on the fritz. You know, if you had a car that was doing that, you would take it into the mechanic and have them fix it or replace the sucker, right? Well, we can't do that. But so the fix to that, as we all know, the fix to that for women is to be on estrogen. So a lot of the early transition stage 1, 2, even 3, a lot of women are put on birth control then because it's an easy way. The pill has enough estrogen in it, like it has a lot of estrogen. As a matter of fact, it's got 4 to 5 times more estrogen in the pill than in hormone replacement therapy. So lots of women in this stage in their 40s are put on continuous birth control pill or, you know, whatever. It gives you enough estrogen to not have these warm flushes and hot flushes. It fixes, it's like taking your brain to the car mechanic and having your thermostat fixed.
Okay. And then why is there sometimes an increase in anxiety and depression during this time?
So that's one of the areas that's really important for women to know, because it's, are you ready for this? I'm going to tell you the numbers. It sort of always still blows my mind. You have a 14-fold increase in depression and anxiety and irritability during the transition years.
Wow.
And it may not be the same every day, may not last, but it's, and okay. So, and the bottom line about why that is and what we know about that is, just think about what I just told you about how the brain has changed with even your thermostat. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of us women think about the PMS days. I don't know about you, but I mean, you know, 80% of women can remember some kind of PMS days, where we call it in my clinic the crying over dog food commercials. So it's, you know, you get this, it gets all, things can just hit you wrong and you feel like what a boot, it's like, you know, or if you're, or worst thing is your partner turns to you and says, are you okay? Is it that time of the month? And you just like lose it at them, right?
Yes.
You just lose it at them because you're thinking like, WTF, like just leave me alone. What are you talking, you know? So, but on some other day you wouldn't react that way. So we're all used to that kind of the PMS. So basically the perimenopause and the transition stage can be PMS intermittently throughout the month. It may not be continuously, but that level of irritability and level of tearfulness and moodiness and just, all of a sudden you see the world, the cup is half empty. Everywhere you look, you're unhappy about everything. You're irritated at everything. So it really is a big mental change in your mood and your happiness. And I've had women come to me. I still remember, I mean, you know, as a doctor, you always learn the most from your patients. And I can remember this one woman, you know, when I first started doing this back in the 1994, 95, and she came and says, Dr. Prism, and here she is, she's got, you know, 2 great kids, they're doing great in school, they've got, you know, whatever, they're living the life in San Francisco, whatever. And she says, Dr. Brizendine, you know, I just want you to know that if I didn't have my kids, I would not want to live anymore. I have no joy in my life.
Whoa.
And okay. You know, I would never have, you know how you read people, you see them, they're like, they have their hair and makeup on, their dress, they're, you know, they just, you would never just guess how miserable they are inside. And that always really, and of course I have many, many, many of those women come to me, and it's part of the perimenopause for a lot of women. And so my job is to just try to say, okay, I know you feel that way and you've been feeling that way for a while. There's a couple of things we can do. So let's start to test drive some options. And first I find out if they're willing to kind of get their hormones, their estrogen rebalanced for at least 2 months to see if we can kind of get a safety net under her. Usually that means just putting her on continuous birth control pill of some kind, just for 2 months to see a test drive, see if we can get some improvement in that. So let's say that works in about a third of women, that approach works in about a third.
Okay.
And then another third of women who are feeling that level of no joy in their life and feeling like they wouldn't want to be here if it weren't for their kids, whatever, you know, that, I mean, they feel suicidal, but they would never do it, you know, because of their family. But they feel that bad that they really don't want to go on. Then for those women, if we've tried the hormone approach, the birth control, a couple of months, I will then add, you know, one of the antidepressant meds, like, you know, Prozac, Paxil, Lexapro, you know, and there's a whole bunch of new ones. And I just, depending on what the woman wants, I try not to kill their libido completely, because, you know, Wellbutrin or bupropion is the only one that doesn't kill your libido out of those drugs. So I try to, you know, also find out about the sexual function that's going on then too, because I don't want to completely like you know, kill that for the woman as well, which the SSRIs, the SSRI drugs or SNRI drugs like, you know, Celexa, Cymbalta, all those Effexor, all those drugs make it so many women can't have an orgasm. It doesn't kill their sex drive, but it kills their ability to have an orgasm. And, you know, if you keep having sex and you don't have an orgasm after a while, you kind of say, like, why bother? Mm-hmm. And so I try to be respectful of that. So that's level two if they're still having those kinds of feelings.
Wait, if when you say level two, you're combining the medication, the antidepressant, for example, with the continuous birth control.
Yes,
you're combining
correct.
The two. And
that
when you
correct.
Say when you say continuous birth control, does that mean without a week of placebo?
Yeah, I don't give them. I mean, a lot of women don't want to have a period at that point. So I just kind of, if you just do it continue, the idea is like you can do continuous for 6 months and then you can let them have a week off of their pills and then they'll have a bleed so that they clean out their uterus from any blood that's there.
Okay.
And then you can put them on it for another 6 months. So that's the easy, we change it depending on things, but that's the easiest way. Just go continuous for 6 months and then you go for 1 week to 10 days without any pill at all, and you'll shed your uterus lining and bleed and then go back on them. So women always time those, that week or 10 days to sometime when they're not, nothing big is going on in their life, you know?
I think it was the introduction of the female brain and you talked about premenstrual dysphoric disorder.
PMDD.
Oh my goodness, PMDD.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And I remember something you said, and I'm thinking about it right now as you're speaking about the women in the transition. Do not make your hormonal fluctuation your reality. And I actually use that for a lot of things. I sort of, you know, changed the language a little bit, but I've always remembered that. So is someone in the menopause transition or maybe even in the upgrade that is experiencing more heightened symptoms of anxiety and depression and having suicidal ideation, is that more common in women that maybe had a history of depression before or anxiety or a history of PMDD?
So it's very interesting because we like to look at postpartum depression and PMDD, all of these what we call hormonally related mood killers, and then the perimenopause and see how related they are. So, the answer to your question is obviously complex because it's very individual. So if somebody's had a history in their family or their own history of clinical depression or clinical anxiety disorder, then yes, some of these points of fluctuating hormones is going to make it, they may get a harder hit with it. But
okay.
They thought that they were trying to correlate, okay, well, how about women who had a postpartum depression? Are they going to be really having a lot of mood problems during the perimenopause, menopause transition from 42 to 52? And the answer is, well, maybe a tiny bit, but not enough to say that there's that one would make it sure that you'd have the other. So I think that's kind of relieving to a lot of women to know, okay, well, if I had really bad PMDD when I was in my 20s or 30s, does that mean I'm going to have a hellish time going through the transition into the upgrade or that 42 to 52-year-old and as the ovaries and the brain wind down? The answer is not necessarily.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay.
On the lookout for it.
Yes.
You're being on the lookout for it, but not necessarily. And also those women, I think, often are more primed to be ready to reach out for some help and get some amelioration with some kind of compounds.
That's such a great point.
Because somebody that's never had anything before and they just get slammed with this joyless place in their life they've never had before, actually, they may be suffering more because they've never had any of this hormonally related mood or brain fog or sleep problems or the things that you get during the transition and the upgrade.
Dr. Brizendine, in your book, I loved how you cut through the controversy and gave the latest guidance around hormone therapy. And I thought it might be good to tell the listeners about the flawed publication in 2002 from the Women's Health Initiative.
Oh, thanks so much, Stigna, for giving me a chance to say something about that because, and you know, remember, so I started the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic, mostly actually because I was looking at the hormone effects on transgender brains that was being done in the Netherlands. They have a big clinic there on how giving male brains estrogen and female brains testosterone like changed a whole lot of things about their cognition and their mood. So we can talk about that later. But that's what got me into this. I started the Women's Mood and Hormone Clinic in 94. And remember, the study we're talking about didn't come out until 2002. So all during the 90s, when I first started practicing and doing this clinic, it's like, it was not hard to give women hormone. That was like, no, you know, there were studies and this study was going on. But then the results of the 2002 totally killed the entire field that I was working in for a while, basically because I'll tell you that when this study came out, within a year, 80% of women on their hormones had been taken off by their doctors.
Wow.
And it still hasn't come back up. I mean, it's still like 75 or 80%. So, and doctors are still like just freaked about that. And that's over 20 years ago now. So the thing that was most flawed in it, there's a bunch of things, is that they didn't start women. Remember, the average age of stopping your last menstrual period is 51.5.
Okay.
51 and a half.
Okay.
But you've been winding down usually for 5 years and you know, the whole thing. So 51. They didn't start women in this study on hormones until they were 64.
Ah.
Thank you for that.
Okay.
Because as a 52-year-old woman yourself, can you imagine?
Oh,
like,
oh gosh. I mean, I'm complaining about the 2 years that I've not been in the
know. 12 years. But the problem is after 12 years, the circuitry and the receptors on the cells and everything that respond to estrogen, they've all gone away. They've died off.
I see. So you
it would be like a lawn. It'd be like a lawn. It'd be like a lawn that you weren't watering for 12 years, and then you try to water a dead lawn and nothing happens.
When is that window, by the way?
So the window. So usually, what we start to do is we start to try in the what I call stage three of the transition. So like age 47 to 51 is the time you really want to start the hormones, because you don't want to have all of those circuitries and the receptors and the estrogen in the brain and the body. You don't want to have everything die off. You know, you don't want your vagina to dry up and get all torn up and, you know, ripped because you don't have any vaginal estrogen. You know, or that's just a thing that most of us are aware of. You know, it's like you can't see in your brain. You don't realize that your brain is drying up too. Anyway, your brain is drying up too. So that was number one. And then the women that were in the group, the placebo group, versus the group that got the hormones. The group that got the hormones, many more smokers in that group for some reason, mm-hmm. and many more smokers and drinkers in that group. So it wasn't a balanced group at all. And then in those days, they weren't testing for the breast cancer gene at all, because the gene hadn't been really laid down. So now what we do is we screen women before we put them. We basically screen women for all of the breast cancer genes. And, you know, those are put in a category where the only thing that they can use a little bit of vaginal estrogen to keep your vagina moist and not dry out. But they should not take the hormone replacement. So in those days, we didn't understand how to basically guide and test drive different people for different things. So now we know that. But so there was. You know, and then they made a very big deal out of small changes in actually some of the group that had estrogen plus progesterone had a little bit more of this or that, and some of them that got estrogen alone because they'd had hysterectomies. Basically, those people have less colon cancer and less, you know. So there were some really good outcomes also of the study that got buried by the other stuff. So. At any rate, no doctor these days would even allow a woman who's been off of hormones up to the age of 64 or 65 to just be put on, because you increase the clotting factors in your blood and you increase the chances of stroke. So ladies, if you're out there and, you know, you have a family history of clotting, you need to talk to your doctor about that. But basically, you need to get on your hormones before that. Remember, at an age... So, the year in 1900, the average age of death for a woman was 49 years old. And I know that's, you know, that number is complicated. But the thing is they didn't even make it to the menopause. You know, having this many women live into the menopause now is a whole new phenomenon in history and in medicine. And so doctors are out there. I mean, I am in a field, I specialize in the brain, in the female brain, in the brain circuits. And I've done that, you know, for all of my life. I mean, I started at UC Berkeley in this area in the 70s. So I've been on this train for a long, long time. And the thing is, OBGYNs, they joke with me, they do below the waist. They say, UCSF, they used to say, we do below the waist, and if you got something above the neck, go see Luann. You know, they'll send them to the Women's Moon Hormone Clinic because they don't want to deal with what goes on in the brain. They're not trained in the brain. I mean, they are mostly surgeons, and they're great. They're car mechanics of the female anatomy below the waist. That's what they do, and they do it really well. And they just got dropped with hormone replacement therapy as being in their area of medicine. And most of them do not like to do it. They're into surgeries. They're into delivering high-risk pregnancies. I mean, they're specialists in stuff that we women all need, definitely. But the majority of them don't like to. They weren't even trained. Only about 20% of the residency training programs in the United States were giving them even more than one lecture on hormone replacement therapy.
And has that dropped since the study?
Oh, That's what happened after the study. After the study, the residency programs in OBGYN just dropped it and they basically just pretended they just don't go there. I mean, you had to go. That's why the whole bioidentical hormone movement started. That's why the, you know, alternative medicine, you know, so the only place you could really get any help was outside of standardized medicine. Now I'm in the world of like straight up, you know, I'm the sliced bread of medicine. I'm in the, you know, in the university setting where we do evidence-based medicine. And so I'm in that category. So, I mean, it's like, but I was kind of like the only clinic in the university setting that was willing to mix and match and change things and test drive different hormone things for different individuals who came to me with different problems and, you know, helping treat trans people who had, you know, whatever specific hormone needs they had, et cetera, et cetera. So that's, you know, not everybody is qualified to do that.
What do you suggest to patients who are in that transition stage, maybe postmenopause, but early postmenopause, trying to get hormone therapy, but you still, I mean, it seems like it's making a comeback, but it still feels kind of new.
Well, it is a little bit because, okay, I'll just give you an example. Okay. I have had a whole year of not having a primary care doctor myself because she transitioned out of the practice where I go. And the three other doctors were covering for the person who left until they found somebody new. That's a little nightmare to have that happen, but it's interesting to see three different doctors try to deal with what I take for myself. I don't like to prescribe. I can prescribe for myself, but I don't like to prescribe for myself because I like to have a doctor following me for my own things. And so the new one came last week, and I had my first visit with a new doctor, and she's, she moved from Palo Alto up to UCSF, and she's a great doctor. She was having a lot of trouble with the tech stuff with that. Medical records at UCSF are different than every place else, go figure. But and I was asking her to renew my hormone prescriptions of the hormones that I take. And she said to me, well, you know, I wouldn't ordinarily do this. She says, I want you to know, I'm only doing this because you're a doctor. And I thought to myself, WTF, like, oh my God, you know, what do you think about that? Cigna. I share my own story because it's like, that's how bad it still is out there.
And I'm glad that you said it because it's like somehow I wouldn't expect that to happen with you, but you also have a pretty good feel for what it's like for most of us
at
that stage.
It's dreadful out there.
Yes.
And this doctor is at least, I would guess that she's at least 55.
Yeah. Right.
So she's been through it herself, you know, but I didn't go there. Anyway, I just want to then do a shout out to all of your audience about, hey, you guys, it's not a smooth sail out there to get this stuff for yourself.
Right.
So
yes, well, having your book as a base before going in would certainly help. So, Dr. Brizendine, most of the women in your book identify as Black, Brown, or Indigenous people that are all cisgender. And for the audience, I just want to remind that cisgender means that, you know, they identify with the gender they were born with. Can you speak a little bit about the upgrade for trans and gender nonconforming bodies with uteruses?
Okay, yes, great. So remember, if you're born with ovaries, you're going to go through the female version of puberty, having a menstrual period, maybe being fertile, maybe having babies, maybe not. And then as you get to this stage of the transition and the upgrade, which is age like, say, 42 to 52, you will therefore go through what we traditionally call perimenopause and menopause as well, if you haven't had those parts removed. So if you are a if you're a trans man, trans male, you will maybe or maybe not still have a uterus and ovaries. And if you're a trans man, you will then, if you do have those body parts still, you will go through menopause and hot flashes and, you know, the things that our cisgender women go through. And so you will need the same things I've been talking about in this book to help you through that one way or another. So if you have then been given testosterone to masculinize your body, your voice, your facial hair, and you know, transition to being a man, but still have those body parts, the uterus and the ovaries, you have a lot of testosterone that you're being given on board. And that amount, remember the cool thing. Okay, here's the cool thing, everybody, about testosterone. Testosterone actually in your body, and in particular in your brain, changes into estrogen. And there's a little enzyme. It's called aromatase. It sounds like a coffee bean, So I think of it as a coffee bean enzyme, aromatase. And aromatase is the enzyme that changes testosterone into estrogen. So even cisgender male, they're running around with lots of estrogen in their brain because of all their testosterone. Okay. So the same thing with a trans man is running around taking all that testosterone with a lot of estrogen in the brain and body. And therefore, my point is, they may not have as much trouble with this transition or the upgrade. They may not have very much trouble with perimenopause and menopause. What their bleeding pattern will be in terms of having very, very heavy bleeding, like that flooding bleeding, like I talk about in the book. Some people just have like flooding, and you're by the time you get out the door, you've already got three or four super Tampax stuffed up there with a couple of extra, the big pads with the wings and everything. You know, you're going out the door ready for war. You know, so even so, trans men will be in that same situation if they still have a uterus and ovaries. Some of them that are going to have this. So probably what they will need to do is they'll probably need to have what's called a progestacert, a progesterone IUD, a Mirena. You know, a lot of people out there will recognize the types of IUDs that have the progesterone in them because it makes it so you don't bleed hardly at all. So okay. It just keeps the uterus from bleeding. So I would think that most trans men who have uteruses don't want to bleed all over the place all the time. So they probably are going to need the Mirena IUD placed there until they get through the menopause.
And what if they do not have a uterus? What if they've had a hysterectomy?
If they had their uterus and ovaries out, which is called a TAHBSO in medicine, which stands for total abdominal hysterectomy and bilateral salping oophorectomy. It's a tongue twister. It basically means you've had your uterus and your ovaries out. Now, a lot of people just have some trans men just will have the uterus out and the ovaries left in for various reasons, because it sort of doesn't matter to leave the ovaries, and they may think that they may want children at some point, so they'll leave the ovaries if they're young enough. I mean, a lot of trans men a lot of them are doing it in their teens now. So there's a lot of trans men that may want to have their own children. And you could do that by just saving the ovaries. So, it's a very individual thing. So if you still have your ovaries and you start to go through the transition, they'll still have, cycling hormones just like a cisgender woman would have. So they still may have some PMS and PMDD. Usually the amount of testosterone they're taking, though, will override all of that and cut down on some of that. But so they may go through some of this even if they left the ovaries behind. But if they have a total abdominal hysterectomy with the ovaries taken out, then they will have no, they've transitioned to those trans men with the uterus and ovaries out will not have, they may abruptly go into what's called surgical menopause. Have you ever?
Yes, I've heard of that.
Okay, so I had a surgical menopause at 52 because I had my ovaries and my uterus out because I had big fibroids at that stage. And I just decided, okay, I'm just going to, because they don't get too big, they can just take your uterus out through your vagina, just like pull it out that way. So I decided I wanted that. Anyway, I had that. And then immediately in the recovery room, they slapped on the estrogen patch on me. And so I've been on the estrogen patch ever since then, the estradiol patch, which you change like twice a week. And that, so I've only had to take estrogen replacement that way via the patch. So those men that end up with that, they'll have an abrupt surgical menopause. If they're on enough testosterone, they may not need estrogen replacement, but they may need a little bit of estrogen as well. Okay. To kind of counteract this abruptly using. So any of your audience that's getting a surgical, getting a hysterectomy and the ovaries are coming out, just have them, just make sure that they put the estrogen patch on you in the recovery room when you're done, just so that you get started right away and you won't fall off a cliff with your estrogen and be sweating through the bed all night, not sleeping, have brain fog. I mean, they used to just let women just, they would just discharge. I mean, they wouldn't do anything. It was terrible. And they would just basically lose their cognition, brain fog, sleep disorder, you know, sweating through everything. And women would take 2 years after their hysterectomy to like recover.
Oh, gosh.
They would retire from their job. They would take sick days off. And nobody was helping these women. Just to finish, round out the other pieces that if they're trans women, so trans women were born, that trans women were male at birth and then transitioned to female. And they obviously don't have ovaries or a uterus, but they do take estrogen, and they take enough estrogen where if the estrogen is stable, they're not going to go through hot flashes. And if their doctor starts changing their estrogen level a lot, they may get hot flashes and may have some brain fog when they're changing the doses. So the trans women may still have some hormonal fluctuations that doctors need to be aware of so they can help them through that sort of what I call fine-tuning balance of their hormones that they need to be on.
Thank you for bringing in these experiences. They really seem to be missing from the mainstream conversation around menopause. Back to hormone therapy for a moment. Let's say that somebody is in the ideal window to take hormone therapy. At what point would somebody go off of hormone therapy?
So that is an area of ... we don't know, and controversy. But I think if people want to see the most evidence-based view, the NAMS, the National Association of Menopause Society, North American Menopause Society, the NAMS website. You can go to the NAMS website and read about this stuff and see what's the au courant, the most current. It used to be that they'd say 5 years that you could be on hormones. Well, that's ridiculous because that doesn't get you anywhere. So now it's more like 10 years. You can still be on the hormones. But actually, those of us who practice in this field and whatever, and, you know, I'm 70 years old now, and I had mine put on at 52, and I'm still taking my estrogen patch. So you have a doctor following your health care, and you have somebody that you're having this discussion with, and there's really no reason to come off of it.
So the chapters on social health, like the chapters on connection, the mommy brain, and relationships in midlife and beyond, I'm going to try to narrow it down because I have so many areas of interest. One area I found really fascinating is when you spoke about how our nervous systems get so intertwined with the people close to us, like our children and partners. And I think I specifically remember Rena's story about being married to a man, and I remember in the book you said that I'm going to diagnose from afar, that maybe he was a narcissist and her nervous system was intertwined with his nervous system. Can you speak a little to what goes on there?
So I have a couple things. I mean, you can imagine we could have a whole.
I know
because this is therapist central, right?
This is therapist central.
And so remember, I'm also a therapist. So I do that.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I do all that. The hormones is not the only thing I do. Okay. So female brain and mirror neurons. So the mirror neurons that we have in our brain and our oxytocin, females are. Mother Nature made female brains the way they are to really be able to track and read other people's emotions and feel their feelings, in the empathy circuits, and feel their pain. Because females were charged with basically, we have to keep helpless infants alive. Since human babies are born at such a helpless stage, they're not capable of taking care. They don't just drop and run like a little giraffe.
Like a giraffe,
you know?
Right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. They don't just drop and run like a little giraffe.
Yeah.
They need to have all kinds, and we are such social creatures that we need to be, we need to belong and stay with our group, otherwise we die. And human female's job, Mother Nature signed us with getting pregnant, carrying pregnancies, and then having the babies, and then keeping them alive and knowing what their need for at least the first 2 years of a very nonverbal life. You know, you're not going to ask usually in words. You need to read the baby's state. Do they need to poop? Do they need to eat? Do they need to get warm? Do they need to sleep? You know, all that stuff you have to kind of just intuit by their behavior. You have to be channeling that infant's nervous system in your nervous system. That's the way you, quote unquote, know what they need.
Okay.
Now, we women don't just do that with babies. We do that with our partners, too. We even do it with our girlfriends. We do it with our parents. We do it with everyone. And, you know, the idea that women, this is a big word I'm going to say right now, saying that the issue of boundaries for women is really hard because of this. You know, it's like we have all the machinery and circuitry in our brains and in our nervous system to track all the feelings of others. And we often, if there's an urgency in the feelings of others, we will suppress our needs to take care of the other. Now, that's good if you have a 2-year-old or 3-year-old, you know, or whatever. And if you have an adult male or an adult other partner or whatever, and yes, I mean, we do channel their energy too. We do know what they need. I mean, I know what my partner needs just kind of, you know, just kind of by looking at her. I know what she needs, and I can just, you know, I can, like, so we do track other people's nervous systems, and there's the good and the bad and the ugly with that.
You say that it can lead to empathetic distress.
Yes. So the empathetic distress is that you are feeling their feelings so much that it's causing you, you know, we have a phrase, it's called those people who treat trauma cases or PTSD cases. It's called PTSD by proxy, you know, and therapists get burnout if they're treating too many patients with horrible, horrible traumas that they treat. You know, you only treat so many of those because it's just really, it takes it out of you because you are basically, you know, you are allowing your nervous system to feel the trauma of your patient up to the point where it allows you to know at some body, physical, emotional level what your patient or client went through. Mm. Or what, and so it's a little bit, for me, I don't know about for you, but it's easier when they're a client of mine because there's a structure, right? There's the 45, 50 minute hour, and there's the start and the stop, you know, and we are trained to do that. But when it comes to our own personal lives, it's almost worse because our whole brain is like, you know, we just do it automatically, you know, automatically. We are able to incorporate, and the more trauma you had in your own childhood as a therapist or whatever, the more, you know, trauma we've had in our own life as children or whatever, you know, hopefully we work through a certain amount of that, but we're always still working through that.
Right.
You're probably more able, the good news is to feel the trauma of other people, The bad news is we're more able to feel the trauma of the other people. And it kind of, so what I'm, you know, that is just the truth.
So Dr. Brizendine, how do we achieve nervous system independence? And there's a metaphor you used about a hula hoop and kind of getting everybody else out of our hula hoop. How would you suggest we start? Okay. What's a baby step?
Let me explain the sentence about hula hoop. And those of you out there that are in 12-step programs will recognize some of where I get this language, because it's like it's a very familiar language when you're trying to deal with you're trying to recoup your own focus on yourself. So one of the mantras in 12-step is like, keep the focus on yourself, keep the focus on yourself. And when you have children, like I know you've got the teenage daughter, I have the son, that whatever, I've had to do personally a lot of work on this issue, which is where I need to focus on myself and not, my son's an adult now, and it's not focused so much on him, because he, of course, hates that, etc. But I mean, so the phrase is, a lot of the kids will say, mom, stay in your own lane, right? Mom, stay in your own lane. Okay, it's a similar thing. It's like, stay in your own hula hoop. Stay in your own hula hoop. Take charge of your own hula hoop and just keep that. Or stay on your own emotional acre. And let them stay on their own emotional acre. I like that one better. It's like, I'm on my emotional acre and my son, he's on his emotional acre. And there's another phrase that goes along with that is like, detach with love.
Oh, right. And there's one other metaphor that I heard at a talk that I love too. Mom, that belongs in your suitcase.
Yes. Right? Mom, that belongs in your suitcase. Yes. And that's great. And it's like, so I think what you're talking about is how we unravel the mommy brain the mommy brain running on estrogen, which we women do, being just overamped on the estrogen and focused so much on the nervous system of others. Because we've, like I talk in the book about the tent of me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you read the stick about the tent of me.
I do.
But, you know, the people we take into our own tent that are very close to us, our children, maybe our significant others, partners, et cetera, and, you know, or even people that probably shouldn't be in there, maybe our somebody that's toxic in our family, our sisters, our brothers, our mother, you know, there's people we need to take out of our tent. And the people that we brought in our tent, though, we really channel their emotions as well as our own. And I think at this stage of life, in order to accomplish the upgrade, mm-hmm. we need to sort out what is ours and what is theirs. It's almost like there's this you're picking, you know how you reach in that drawer with a whole bunch of tangled cords of all of your,
yes.
all of your connectors from the last 10 years of your computer, Sophia, is that drawer with all of the stuff that's, you pull that out. And that's what your nervous system looks like entangled with somebody else's.
Oh, that's such a great metaphor. You know, and it's so tricky too, when I think about my daughter, lately I've really been keeping my eye out for not making my experiences, the history of me, her experiences, because they're different experiences. We're different people.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so being aware that the one thing I do love about the midlife brain and beyond, assuming there's an upgrade, is that all of this stuff is going on, but there is this increased awareness that seems to be there as well. So it's like you can see it. You're more like watching the movie of you versus like being in the movie of you.
I agree. Because so like it's in that, these life transitions can only happen when you do just what you said. So when you're totally embedded in the movie of me, you've got an infant that you're breastfeeding every 2 or 3 hours or what, you know, remember that stage of life, which is like a whole nother, I mean,
yes.
You are taken over by that. But right now in this transition and into the upgrade, you need to have the view is like, oh, I did that. That was me. And I'm over here now and I can kind of see the movie of me.
Yes.
It's like you're not so embedded in it that you can't see it. So you're able to step back and see it a bit, just a bit.
Yes.
And it's not like, I mean, it's not like you're going to abandon everybody you love. You're not going to abandon the love you have for your daughter. Whatever. But she would be very happy, mom, if you'd just step back a little bit, you know?
Exactly. Yes. But that awareness is so cool. wouldn't want to trade it for anything, and it gives you more of a choice.
Choices at this stage are everything.
Right.
And choices are scary. Now, I want to just warn your audience, this process is a scary process sometimes. It is also liberating and joyful.
Yes. Yes.
And it is also very scary because you're trying to do something different than what your nervous system that's incorporated everybody else's nervous system into you is doing. So you're starting to untangle those cords in the bottom of that drawer.
Nice. In Rena's story, where she, in this case, was intertwined with her husband's nervous system, and he had a fair amount of imbalance, let's say. What I thought was so interesting is that when she finally got out of the marriage and started dating, she was subconsciously drawn to a nervous system that was familiar to her, like her husband. And she found nervous systems that were different, say like trying to date a nice guy, she found it boring.
That's classic. I'm sure as a therapist, you know that. I mean,
I do, but not, I do know it, but not from a nervous system perspective. So
yes.
It's like, that is a really new layer for me. But how did she sort of retrain her nervous system to seek something more unfamiliar and more balanced?
So it's very interesting because the nervous system seeking something that's familiar I think all of your audience and both you and me, we would like to not repeat something we've repeated in the past that hasn't been a place where we're being our most authentic, joyful, free self, right? And that getting involved again with somebody who's so similar to somebody else just because it feels familiar is not a place any of us would like to go. So it's a new experience, perhaps, walking into someone who makes us feel uncomfortable because our nervous system is telling us there's something wrong, even though there was something wrong with where we came from. It's that we're going someplace new that's kind of right. I mean, it's kind of like graduating from high school and going off to college. I mean, everything, of course, was new, but things didn't feel comfortable that first two or three weeks at college, you know, or whatever. It just, everything was new. Everybody was new. There was a lot of pull towards the comfort and familiarity maybe of home. So in a way, we are leaving home. In a way, during the upgrade and the transition upgrade, we're having the opportunity to sort of leave home yet again, which is leaving behind some things that have not been useful for us and ways in which we've had to intertwine our nervous system with other people. And we are kind of reclaiming our own independent nervous system, which is preparing us for the next stage when the kids are the empty nest, the kids are out of the house. And you have some options to make, you know, what is it in the United States? 57% of the new businesses are started by women over the age of 50.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of women are clearly like just coming into their full authenticity at this stage. Or I've had a couple of friends that at age 60, they always felt they're males. One of them was the chief of surgery at San Francisco General, and she tells her own story. But you know, she went through her transition transitioned to female at that stage because that's, you know, even though she had a wife and three kids. I mean, it was like, people sometimes step into their authenticity in ways that have been pulling at them forever. And that's, of course, a very dramatic example. But I think to contemplate that and think that you, whoever you are, it's possible now in a way that it may not have been possible in your life before now.
I see. Thank you for that. Well, Dr. Brizendine, I want to thank you for once again drawing attention to such a neglected aspect of women's health and for reclaiming the upgrade. It's so exciting to think about it as the wisdom phase that emerges for women as they potentially get happier with age.
Thank you for having me. I just love talking to your audience. It's my audience. And I just encourage you ladies just to scream, upgrade, upgrade, upgrade. I'm coming over to that emotional acre. That's the emotional acre I want to be standing on.
I love that.
It's a work in progress. And I will confess, I'm still working on getting on my, claiming my emotional acre over there. And just know that I want to hear about all of yours. And we'll do it. We'll walk side by side as we do it together.
I love it. Thank you so much. And thank you for joining us today for part one of a 3-part series on menopause for Therapy Rocks. Stay tuned for next month's part two episode with an expert on the physical changes in midlife and beyond. Reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen.